This is a narrative about detection, law, and the enigma of social order in one corner of the late modern world, and perhaps elsewhere as well. In July 1997, a major South African TV network aired what it described as one of the few success stories in a police force that has almost collapsed under the strain of democracy, unquote. It focused on Jackson Khopane, an inspector specializing in murder investigations in Limpopo, a rural province with a very high incidence of homicide, even by national standards. In South Africa, murder rates have become diagnostic of violence run amok, of government threatened by a brutal legacy that no constitutional reform, public reconciliation, or ritual restitution can fully dispel. Khopane, it appeared, was unusually adept at bringing killers to book. Indeed, he was no ordinary investigator. In the course of his inquiries, he moved between the forensic and the oracular, detection and divination, exchanging his police uniform and gun for the dress and demeanor of a traditional healer. In him, scientific investigation met the social diagnostics of the seance. He was, in short, South Africa's first officially recognized diviner detective, although, as we'll see, there were soon to be others. Now, this is a peculiarly local story, a tale of unforeseen consequences as a notorious racial state morphed into a democratic post-colony. But the news feature on Khopane suggested something more, that the end of authoritarian rule here had also meant the end of authoritative governance, that the coming of democracy had seriously challenged the state's ability to police itself, that even more scandalously, there might be an inherent contradiction between popular empowerment and the sovereign force of the law. These sentiments accord with a widespread local perception, especially among whites and members of the new black middle class, that the post-apartheid government lacks will and capacity to monopolize the means of violence. And this sentiment, of course, has been quite widely echoed in the unrest unleashed in South Africa in the past couple of weeks. In the effort to convert what was the jackboot of the apartheid state into a police service rooted in human rights, this sense that the law lacks a bite has been enhanced. There's a sense that discipline has crumbled in the face of the unruly. All of which is exacerbated by policies of liberalization, under whose sway a swelling army of security companies and private police forces have been enfranchised. And there's been a turning of a blind eye to vigilante operations that offer protection to the hoi polloi. Amidst intensifying hysteria over allegedly unprecedented levels of crime and corruption, there have been mounting calls for a return of the death penalty, this being the most pointed of a range of popular efforts to goad the state to take back sovereign control over life or death, to restore the sublime authority of the law, as it were. A recent directive to the police by the South Africa's Deputy Minister of Safety and Security responds to this sentiment. We talked about it the other evening. And I quote, "Criminals are hell-bent on undermining the law, and they must now be killed," she declared. "You've been given guns, now use them." Indeed, the media frequently depict a kind of Hobbesian disintegration of civility, a blurring of the line between legitimate and illegitimate force, of the identity of those who preserve the law and those who pervert it. In such circumstances, the metaphysical basis of order itself is called into question. As trust erodes in the state as principled protector of the people, more mythic, enchanted sources of sovereignty, of theo-legality, if I can call it that, have been sought. Here the arcane, personified in the mystique of figures like Khopane, enters into the experience of the everyday workings of enforcement. There is a marked tendency in South Africa to see crime as at once ordinary and mysterious, cynical and spectral, only to be expected yet incomprehensibly excessive. Crime confounds ordinary understanding, demanding novel means to plumb its enigmas and reverse its effects. It would seem that in all this, the longing for regulation is not merely a desire for protection alone, or even for authoritative security. It appears also to be a yearning for order as a kind of ontological insurance, one that comes from drawing a clear line between law and lawlessness. from reducing the mysterious dimensions of Violence Unbound into more manageable forms. Now, does the appeal of a figure like Kulpani stem, perhaps, from the fact that he embodies this desire? Certainly, his occult forensics seem to promise that, even in uncanny times, people will not get away with murder. For what makes him and his kind singular is the capacity to detect the pattern that underlies the mystery, the metaphysics of disorder that is so palpable in this particular here and now. Now, despite its uniquely South African flavor, the story has echoes elsewhere. Scholars of Latin America and post-Soviet Europe have noticed that democratization, especially in the context of sharp, long-standing inequalities, is often accompanied by an increase in violent crime and corruption, by an erosion of the force of law, by the rise of what Derrida has called criminal phantom states. The sense that order is somehow spooky, that crime has taken on phantasmic proportions, is quite widely apparent. A BBC News report from Kenya, describing the mayhem that followed the recent national election, added that, and I quote, "the threat of witchcraft has scared looters into returning goods they stole during the unrest. People turned to witchcraft when they realized that the police were powerless to prevent their livelihoods from being destroyed," unquote. Witchcraft imposes a spectral sanction where regular enforcement fails, meeting out retributive violence well beyond the capacities of the law. But this popular insecurity has wider resonances yet. Several observers have remarked that a culture of popular punitiveness is characteristic of criminal justice, political rhetoric, and the spirit of the law in much of the post-Cold War West. They note that it is fueled by a lively sense that levels of brutality and corruption have become unfathomable, uncontrollable, mysterious. Faith-based programs of prison reform, abetted by the spirit of liberalization, are growing in the US and also here in the UK. Says Florida's Governor Jeb Bush, who is a champion of these programs, and I quote him, "Government alone will never solve the problems tearing at the fabric of our society," unquote. For increasing numbers of the faithful, only God can do that. This culture of popular punitiveness then tends to question the state's ability to counter elusive evils that seem to evade the law, which is precisely what the Kulpani story was about. Now, Walter Benjamin may have insisted that the power of the police is ghostly, and I quote him, because its all-pervasive violence takes over at the point where the state is unable to govern as it wishes by legal means. Brutal enforcement, especially in respect of stigmatized minorities, is an enduring feature of the late modern world, to be sure. Yet increasingly, this brutality exists along with a spookiness of a different kind, a sense of a weakening of the forces of order, even a withdrawal of the state from its would-be subjects, a sense of abandonment by the forces of the law. This is not confined to contexts like South Africa. An election poster mounted in downtown Sheffield by the Conservative Party in 2001 showed a frail woman walking fearfully across a deserted housing estate. Its logo: "You paid your taxes, so where are the police?" Elsewhere, I have noted that new cartographies of disorder are apparent across the world, especially in post-colonial terrains, where spaces of relative privilege are linked to one another by vulnerable corridors across zones of unruliness and minimal governance. Here, the reach of the state is often uneven, and the landscape is a palimpsest of contested sovereignties, codes, and jurisdictions, a complex choreography of police and paramilitaries, private and community enforcement, gangs and vigilantes, highwaymen and outlaw armies. The unequivocal monopolization of violence that for Benjamin grounds the harsh law of the modern state, and that for Hobbes was the very condition of the social contract, is in question in many places, rendering ambiguous the sovereignty of the polis and the basis of moral and social being. In such circumstances, where the efficacy, source, and legitimacy of enforcement are often uncertain, the public imagination dwells often obsessionally on wresting law from disorder. And here is the crux of the conundrum. Could it be that this is why, in the face of the criminal obsessions that have gripped South Africa and other places like it, policing, and above all inspired detection, has become the object of such strong, even excessive, affect. Could this investment perhaps be seen as an impetus to fetish, and here I use the word to fetishize, both in the sense of Marx and Freud, those who actually enact the separation of law from lawlessness? Might one argue that there's a tendency to freight these figures with an undue capacity to conjure, metonymically as it were, the fabric of the social order itself? And could it also be, in true Freudian fashion, that these enforcers, these super cops of one kind or another, serve as stand-ins for a profound sense of lack? Indeed, their uncanny efficacy draws attention to a disturbing absence of sovereign law, to a sense of fatal exile from normative security, as was inscribed in the paternal protection of the state. Detective investigation would seem to be good to think with in this respect, because it's never truly been separated from the divining arts. Classic writers like Poe and Conan Doyle might have insisted that modern detection turned on the cunning interrogation of clues and the inspired application of deductive reason. But their prose simultaneously underscores a sense of the limits of rationality. The detective retains a certain mystique. The master crime analyst, says Poe, does not merely calculate, and I'll quote him, he is fond of enigmas, conundrums, hieroglyphics, exhibiting in his solutions a degree of acumen which appears to the ordinary apprehension as being preternatural. And this is especially true in contrast with the regular police. Now, in what follows, I examine three instances of what we might call preternatural policing in South Africa, using them to throw light on law, longing, and the paradoxes of sovereignty in this particular time and place. And the first case is called Donker Jonker, the strange case of God's detective. The first case is an instance of preternatural apprehension at its most literal. The occult-related crimes unit was founded within the South African Police Services in 1992, when the transition to majority rule was in full swing, amidst extraordinary high levels of violence and public anxiety. It is also worth noting, though, that at precisely this time, cult cops of a similar persuasion were actively raising awareness of the presence of sensational ritual crimes in the USA. The South African unit was tasked with the investigation of illegal acts, and I quote, resulting from the practice of any occult science or belief system, and was most directly concerned with homicide, a good deal of it the result of witchcraft-related violence. Its founder and moving spirit was Colonel Kobus Jonker, widely known by the nickname Donker, which means dark in Afrikaans. A seasoned police officer, Jonker was also an ardent born-again Christian, and he was dubbed God's detective by the popular media. Sharp and dedicated, he was strikingly articulate in both Afrikaans and English. While he was quick to tell us that his task as an officer of the law was to track down and prosecute killers, Jonker refused to force an easy distinction between diabolical beliefs and felony. This opposition simply made no sense from the perspective of the occult-related crimes unit. In Jonker's view, Satanism and witchcraft are at root the same phenomenon, and they lead inevitably to violence. And there's a good deal of both of them around, he was arguing. His legal theology, in fact, tends towards the apocalyptic, and he's on record as saying things like the devil has made a revolutionary reappearance in the new South Africa. Now, his fears have resonance in both black and white populations, where rising anxieties about Satanism and witchcraft have been a factor in what one might term a more general metaphysics of disorder, and also the embrace of born-again faiths that has accompanied the rise of the new regime. Among its many activities, the occult-related crimes unit waged valiant battle against satanic subcultures held by the more prurient press to be rampant among disaffected white teenagers. And to this end, it prompted public awareness campaigns, prepared study manuals, and offered seminars in a range of institutions and organizations. But this is more my point. Jonker's ambitions were broader than merely to educate South Africans about the arcane hazards that haunt their post-colonial landscape. He sought to introduce a new kind of policing capable of dealing with them. Now, Jonker was preoccupied above all with making occult-related crimes susceptible to investigation and prosecution. Ironic echoes here of a long struggle to subject the rogue violence of witchcraft to the hegemony of colonial law. Notwithstanding the popular view, especially in the north and northwest, that there's a palpable epidemic of magical evil afoot in the land. Legal records confirm that very few homicides connected with witchcraft or ritual murder or Satanism ever come to court. Jonker offered a hard-boiled answer to this puzzle. For one thing, he noted, most police officers simply do not know how to recognize occult crime scenes. Nor, as a result of their ignorance, are they able to divine motives from the clues recoverable from these scenes. It seems that the rationalist assumptions underlying modern detection are insufficient to decipher the traces left by these arcane crimes of our times. Even if one could read them, Jonker contended, witnesses and other relevant parties, including many police, would be too scared to testify against those able to kill by magical means. This, in part, is why the unit spends so much time on education. Its personnel believe fervently that if occult evil is to be effectively policed, both the cops and the public have to be taught how to recognize the signs of occult violence wherever they present themselves. Jonker gave us a quick rundown of these signs, drawing geometric shapes in the air, describing hard-to-visualize materia medica, and showing us amazing objects, ostensibly of covert ritual purpose, housed in a private pedagogic museum that he has off his office. Now, from the time that he founded his unit, Jonker made frequent appearances on television to popularize his work. His website was set out as a public resource. In addition, a film was made about him by a highly respected US documentary series. With a moral panic occasioned by the frequency of witch and zombie-related killings in the countryside in the 1990s, his unit set up a national workshop on the forensics of occult crime scenes. Now, this led to doubts voiced about the constitutionality of his operation, allegedly because it criminalized indigenous cultures. But despite the unease with which Jonker's crusade was viewed by some members of the South African police mainstream, he was treated with a degree of tolerance, precisely because he sought to tackle a conundrum not resolvable by more regular means. Whatever they thought of his enchanted theories, his colleagues needed him, and not only his colleagues. At the height of his mission, Jonker was said to receive 50 calls a day. On one occasion, when I was in his office, the Archbishop of Cape Town called him to arrange an urgent meeting. Now, although forced by ill health to retire in 2001, Jonker has remained in the public eye, serving as a consultant on matters of occult crime. When the mutilated body of a boy thought to be of African descent was pulled from the River Thames in 2001, Scotland Yard cited Jonker's expert testimony to the effect that the victim had been the object of ritual murder. This evoked accusation by some anthropologists in this country and others that the Yard was being fed racist myths by Satan hunting fundamentalists. Similar controversy surrounds the theories promulgated by cult cops in the US, whose popular seminars on satanic crime have been recognized as offering continuing education credit to police and community professionals across the country for over two decades. Cops on my own university campus have had those seminars. Critics argue that this movement expresses evangelical views that target minority cultural practices, among them Mexican-American and Afro-Caribbean rituals like Santeria, all of which underlines an ever more animated interplay between law and faith. More than this, it dramatizes both the occulting of crime and disorder and the charisma of those who promise to subject uncommon violence to the terms of forensic reason. Okay, now for something different, of scorpions and supercops. Now, on the face of it, the story of the scorpions, South Africa's crack special investigation unit, established, and I quote, urgently to deal with all national priority crime, including police corruption, this seems to be an altogether more mundane matter. But as we shall see, it also takes on fantastic proportions, casting the scorpions as unlikely tragic heroes in an epic battle for the soul of the nation. It all began in the late 1990s, when the idyll of liberation and reconciliation was giving way to harsher post-colonial realities. The country had become embroiled in a series of scandals that had brought charges of crime and corruption into the very heart of government. Key here were accusations against high-level officials involved in the so-called arms deal, a controversial $4.8 billion package contracted by the government to modernize its defense equipment. acrimonious debate raged in the media and in the halls of power as to the need for this expenditure, especially in light of the country's immense social welfare need. Meanwhile, suspicion surfaced about the methods of procurement at work in the deal. Rumour had it that ANC functionaries were enriching themselves in their kin at public expense, and that unscrupulous international manufacturers had bribed local subcontractors, members of parliament, and military personnel. There were also reports of well-placed efforts to quash an investigation into the matter being undertaken by an all-party public accounts committee. All this is very well known, I'm sure, to members of this audience. Now, as tension mounted, the chief whip of the Pan-African Congress, who was in support of an independent inquiry into the matter, handed a dossier of potentially incriminating documents to Willem Heath, current head of the Special Investigation Unit, SIU, the state body then mandated to tackle high-level crime and corruption and to recover monies lost by the state. Heath had been a judge under the apartheid regime, and he proved fearless in wielding his commission to investigate malfeasance among the rich and the influential. His authority involved an unusual blend of the investigative and the prosecutorial. The SIU had the right to subpoena witnesses, to summons documents, to seize and search, with the aim of pursuing litigation. Heath, who had a for theatrics, was accused by some of a gratuitous overuse of his right to raid and confiscate. Having, and here I quote, swapped his musty robes for a Superman outfit, this is Johnny Steinberg remarking, he assumed the role of a rampant cowboy on the frontier. All this proved immensely popular with those longing for an emphatic demonstration of the rule of law. Yet Heath's autonomy was compromised. Despite its mandate, his unit remained answerable in the last instance to the ruling executive. When pushed, government asserted its own sovereignty above that of the law. As the battle surged around the arms deal, President Mbeki issued a demand on national TV that he hand over the documents, declaring that the SIU was an organ of state that had run out of control, precipitating a situation of ungovernability. Faced with a refusal to comply, Mbeki announced plans to reconstitute Heath's unit with somebody other than a judge at its head. And at this point, independent investigation into the arms deal seemed moot. The new improved Directorate of Special Operations, the DSO, came into being in 2001. It was heralded as a world-class enforcement agency, trained by the FBI, and comprising 2,000 of the best police, financial, and intelligence experts in the country. Christened the Scorpions, the unit fell under the National Prosecuting Authority rather than the police, retaining the novel prosecutor-led investigation that had been initiated by its predecessor. The Scorpions also inherited a kind of aura of crusading machismo. "It sounds like it's been named with a television spin-off in mind," wrote a bemused BBC correspondent. "Perhaps an American series along the lines of Starsky and Hutch or Serpico." The image was reinforced by the Scorpions' insignia, a less than subtle reminder that they intended to apply the law with deadly dispatch. Multiplying their venomous totems, if I can put it this way, their homepage featured images like hooded cobras ready to strike against corruption. The homepage also provided a link enabling fans to download ringtones featuring the menacing heavy metal band, the Scorpions, of the same name. A gritty reality TV video of a team of photogenic mixed-race Scorpions on a raid drew thousands of hits and rave ratings on YouTube. As this suggests, the unit has been no less able than Judge to resist the popular craving for forensic drama. Almost immediately, they set about their mission as crime busters extraordinaire, the media amplifying their image as ace investigators by stressing the contrast between them and what the media regularly termed the slipshod South African police service. Media also underlined the DSO's almost uncanny capacity to break into seemingly arcane webs of global corporate corruption and money laundering with novel means of forensic accountancy, establishing them as kind of diviner detectives of finance capital, if I can put it this way. Admiring reports detailed the unit's ability to outwit corporate and public fraudsters, to secure mythic conviction rates, to recover millions of misappropriated public funds. I quote, Drug kingpins, smugglers, and racketeers have all felt the scorpion's sting. And another, a major gang that smuggled platinum, South Africa's biggest foreign export earner, to corrupt English smelting plant, has been busted by the scorpions. So we see that crusading detectives defend national patrimony in the face of a brace of new post-colonial adventurers, dealers in blood diamonds, contraband substances, endangered species. The DSO also played a decisive role in convicting Mark Thatcher for his part in the attempted plot launched from South Africa to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea. But what really secured the unit's superhero status with large sections of the public was the zeal with which it investigated corruption among top-ranking members of government. In this, the scorpions, like Heath, would overestimate their mandate, although their rogue authority was treated at first with indulgence by those in high office, who seemed to have found it useful for their own ends. The scorpions went forth as mythic crusaders. Barely was the unit constituted that it began aggressively to probe parliamentarians who had falsified official expenses. It also returned boldly to the arms dealer. As a warm-up, it secured the conviction in 2003 of the ANC chief whip Tony Ngeni for failing to declare a sweet deal on a Mercedes 4x4 arranged by an arms dealer. Ngeni at the time was the chair of Parliament's Joint Standing Committee on Defence, which oversaw the deal. Even more audacious action followed. Theatrical raids on the homes of high-ranking ANC politicians, Deputy President Jacob Zuma and Transport Minister Mac Maharaj, and a prominent businessman, Shabir Sheikh, who would then be convicted for bribing Zuma on behalf of a French company bidding for their share of the arms deal. While Mbeki, supposedly fearing political backlash, had refused to allow Zuma to be charged along with Sheikh, he now fired the deputy president, who was duly charged with corruption. Released on bail, as we know, Zuma is still to come to trial. As is well known, he was subsequently cleared of a rape charge, and with the plummeting popularity of Mbeki himself, has emerged as a populist hero, leader of the ANC, and ostensible victim of the sitting president's efforts to stifle his succession as head of state. For their part, the scorpions continued to incriminate Mbeki's rival. In a soap opera that enthralled the nation, they conducted televised dawn raids on his private Zuma's private residences in Johannesburg and KwaZulu-Natal, seizing documents and hard drives. I'll give you a flavour of this from one typical account. There was plenty of drama as a standoff ensued between Zuma's heavily armed bodyguards and gun-toting scorpions at his home. Only a timely intervention by officials saw an amicable solution. The scorpions were allowed to complete their search with arms laid down. So you see the whole contestation of sovereignty that's going on here. Private cops, state cops, scorpions, and so on. Even more portentously, the DSO would, and here I quote again, cordon off the seat of government in the union buildings in Pretoria, bringing normal state business completely to a halt as they pored over papers they thought might be relevant to their case. Acting in the name of the law, they subjected the state itself to their authority. And while their extravagant exploits thrilled the public, they drew harsh criticism from some quarters, not least from the core of Zuma's support base, the Congress of South African Trade Unions and the South African Communist Party, that accused the scorpions of Hollywood theatrics and openness to political manipulation. There was sharp resentment, too, among the regular police. And Mbeki went so far as to appoint a commission to investigate the scorpions' mandate and efficacy. This was in October 2005. The commission found that the unit's modus operandi was effective and constitutional, although it did add that the scorpions were inappropriate in the way that they courted publicity and they should perhaps be subject to more political oversight. Undaunted, the scorpions pursued an equally surreal investigation of none other than Jackie Salibi, head of the South African Police Service and then president of Interpol this moment. A colourful character, Salibi was long rumoured to fraternise with drug warlords. In early September 2007, unconfirmed reports circulated in the press that, based on evidence provided by the scorpions, warrants of arrest had been issued against him. Salibi was alleged to have received money over a 5-year period from a convicted criminal, Glenn Agliotti, suspected of the murder of a flamboyant mining magnate, ANC, a patron and suspected racketeer. Before the warrants had been officially acknowledged, President Mbeki suspended the head of the National Prosecuting Authority, i.e. that's the body in charge of the Scorpions, their big boss, in an action widely seen as an effort to shield Salibi from being charged, but also to rein in the supercops. Yet by early January 2008, Mbeki announced that Salibi was to take extended leave of absence, and by month's end he was in court facing charges of corruption and defeating the ends of justice. Now, it's remarkable, given all this, that the Scorpions lasted as long as they did before being brought to heel. By this point, there were few in high office who could not have been threatened by their sting. The election in December 2007 of the irrepressible Zuma as leader of the ANC and probable heir to the presidency sealed their fate. The very same party Congress that anointed Zuma called for the dismantling of the Scorpions, whose investigative responsibilities were to be relocated into the regular police. There were reports accusing them of sheltering former apartheid security police and acting like an opposition party with the aim of fighting the ANC. Howls went up across the nation. The parliamentary opposition accused the ruling party of trying to protect its leader and preempt further investigation of the arms deal. Editorials lamented the message sent to the outside world, and blogs complained that the DSO was being punished for its success and for highlighting the mediocrity of the regular police and enforcement. There were even calls for a national referendum on the matter. The destruction of the Scorpions, wrote respected journalist Mondli Makanya, is an issue which civil society, organized business, and the silent majority within the ANC should use to put democracy itself to the test. Prince Mashele, head of the Crime and Justice Program at the respected Institute for Security Studies, noted, and I quote him, "In talking to ordinary South Africans, one gets the impression that the Scorpions have become the trusted saviors of the people." The Idemisi, went on, sounded a death knell for the country's culture of accountability and respect for the rule of law, signaling, and this was the sting, the Nigerianization of South Africa. Pollsters claimed an almost two-thirds majority of South Africans were in an opposition to dissolving the union. A national online petition, SOS, Save Our Scorpions, gathered thousands of signatures. Others took to the courts. A Johannesburg businessman, Bob Glenister, a.k.a. Concerned Citizen, filed an urgent application to the Pretoria High Court seeking to prevent the government from enacting legislation to dissolve the unit. This matter, as you probably know, is now with the Constitutional Court. Disbanding the DSO in this matter, he argued, would violate citizens' rights, using Parliament to effect the reckless desire to destroy a functioning institution. As if to underline this outrage and the Scorpions' uncommon skills, it's recently been announced that their boss, Leonard McCarthy, has been made head of the World Bank's anti-corruption unit. Now, we are yet to see the denouement of this epic tale, but its fetish quality seems apparent in the mythologization of the Scorpions' investigative powers, their capacity to embody this uncompromising sovereignty of the law, to draw a definitive line over and over again in public between order and corruption. Also in the way in which their demise has been taken as diagnostic of the slide of South Africa towards that icon of post-colonial depravity, Nigeria. This is in the South African. But here again, we must ask ourselves, why the exit? And we must acknowledge the connivance of both the Scorpions and the populace in the enactment of this fantasy. There's a kind of reciprocal inflation that goes on here. What does it tell us more broadly about sovereignty law and the metaphysics of disorder here and now? My final case is called the Tokolosh of Matlonyane. And the third tale of preternatural policing takes us far from the orbit of national melodrama. Drawn from the annals of ordinary enforcement in the rural Northwest province, it illuminates a different face of forensic fetishism, the poignant popular faith that cops might be capable of solving new mysteries emerging in challenging times, a faith to which the police, especially in small-scale communities, often feel compelled to respond, even when they appear to lack the authority and the wherewithal to do so. Early in January 2000, our attention was drawn to a troubling case that had been brought to the police station at Lomanyaneng, a small village near Mafeking, capital of the Tsidi Rolong chieftain and a regional centre for the South African police in the province. The liaison officer stationed there, Captain Patrick Asaneng, first told us about it. An impressive spokesperson for the service, Asaneng was also a lay leader in the Catholic Church, and he was to be centrally involved, again as a diviner detective of sorts, in the effort to solve this case. From the next day and for several weeks, the local newspapers, the Mail, it's an old style, used to be the Mafeking Mail, and Sepone, which is the Setswana for mirror, carried the story of this case with accompanying photographs. And we ourselves came to know it from repeated interviews and visits to those involved. The trouble began in a desperately poor homestead of the Sojeke family with a series of uncanny events. An intruder had entered the square mud house in which slept an elderly grandmother, her two grandsons, and the first of whom, Tsamaiso, was 12. Their father, Obed, was away looking for work at the time, but returned soon after the night in question. His wife, the mother of the boys, was estranged. She lived out there somewhere, said the old woman, gesturing vaguely across the veld. The assailant had harassed the family with obvious violence. It, because as we shall see, the source of the trouble was not quite human, set upon Tsamaiso, swore volubly at everybody in the quiet, morally virtuous household, and destroyed most of their few possessions. Nor was this the only attack. The Sajekes repeatedly suffered from being spat, pinched at, throttled by night, and so on. In one remarkable incident, kin visiting from a nearby village were severely stoned. Another onslaught, even more extraordinary, involved photographs. And this comes to my question about clue reading, which underlies a lot of this. From Sepone, this local newspaper, the family had carefully cut out an article in Setswana about their case, complete with photographs, the word is dinepe from the English word snaps, among which was an unforgettably doleful portrait of the grandmother. The image had been thumbtacked onto a colour picture of the Kaiser Chiefs, one of the country's most popular soccer teams, and rudimentarily framed in glass. The attacker had wrenched the whole thing from the back shelf of the house and thrown it against the wall in the front room. It had, it seems, been offended by the effort to confine it. Clear evidence of this was all shown to the police. One of the policemen said that he thought maybe the Tokolosh was a supporter of the rival Morocco Swallows, but that was not. Soon after they were set upon, the Sojeke family had gone to lay a charge of assault at the Lomanyaneng police station. This in itself is noteworthy. It would probably not have happened during the apartheid years, when there were few black police in the area anyway, and in any case, they were treated with great suspicion as lackeys of white oppression. Africans, as a rule, did not expect protection from the law, and one certainly would not have assumed that its officers, whatever their colour, would be appropriate interlocutors on matters of superhuman attack. As it was, the desk officer had some difficulty translating the Sojeke's complaint into the technical language of charges and dockets. Patently there'd been an assault, but who was the assailant? A Tikolosh, said Obed, Tsamaiso's father, who would later also accuse it of trying to strangle him. Now, a Tikolosh or Tokolosh, depending on where you are in the country, as South Africans know, because it's part of the national imaginary, is a witch familiar. A squat, hairy figure with a long penis slung over its shoulder, its cultural home was once held to be the Eastern Nguni-speaking parts of the country, which many Sotho-Tswana still believe are the centres of traditional culture in the post-colony. But Tokoloshes, which terrify those afflicted by them, have recently been held to migrate into the interior and elsewhere in the country. And one of them, the Sojeke family, was convinced was causing their problem. The police at Lomanyaneng, all of them Botswana, took the case very seriously, to the extent that for several nights they allowed Obed and his eldest son to actually take refuge in the police station. Apart from all else, young Tsamaiso had been grievously hurt, and property in the house had been destroyed. Nothing was missing, so there was no question of robbery, and the injuries could not physically have been inflicted either by the very frail grandmother or the little brother, the only people at home when the trouble began. Nor was there any evidence that this family, which lived a remarkably isolated life, had fallen into conflict with neighbours, kin, or anyone else. But how could the police track down a Tikolosh or arrest a witch familiar? Perhaps this was a case for the likes of Donker Jonker in his occult-related crimes unit, but he was very far away. But the local police were not inactive. This is what's interesting. They responded vigorously, and not merely by giving refuge to the victims of the attack. The officers at Le Magnanin called in Captain Assenet from the regional headquarters, and he decided to put some less than usual resources to work. Given that they could not arraign the Tricolores, what exactly was to be done? How was the spirit of the law to be brought to bear upon spirits of a rather different elusive kind? Assenet confessed that the case had presented a conundrum. It was not technically a crime, although the family had just cause in complaining of assault, and a serious disturbance had obviously occurred in the neighbourhood. On these grounds, he concluded, the matter must be the responsibility of community policing. Despite the fact that it fell outside of the domain of conventional practice, narrowly defined, the police all seemed to feel called upon to assist in resolving it. And they did so by drawing inventively on a wide synthetic array of popular techniques in this unstable zone between enforcement and healing. Assenet himself took the unusual step of visiting the family, first with the local media and later with a prophet healer. He confessed that he'd taken the media, the so-called local Bob TV and the Mail and Siponia, the newspapers, in the hopes that publicising the case might draw forth other forms of assistance in the community. Above all, though, he hoped to be able to prove once and for all what was or was not causing the trouble by apprehending it on film. But much to the distress of all, none of the Tricolores' effects were visible to the video recorders. Assenet insisted that the tape shot by the TV company was switched inexplicably on fast forward all the time they were inside the house. Now, there are multiple ironies here. Assenet hoped that the camera would provide proof that would solve the mystery. Shades here of Benjamin again, who claimed that there was a close allegiance between the space of photography and the scene of the crime. That the photographer, who was the descendant of the Ogoro diviner, was somehow able to turn the contingent traces that crime left in the world into evidence and therefore subject them to the rule of law. But in respect of the Tricolores, this transformation didn't take place, and its failure merely confirmed the eeriness of the uncanny, the challenge in the situation of these sorts of spectral crimes for forensic reason. Again, we encounter the sense that it's impossible somehow to elicit unambiguous truth from the material clues in the manner that modernist detection would dictate. The Sejekes, for their part, had a somewhat different set of expectations. Recalling widely recorded belief that souls and spirits can be arrested or captured by the camera, they had hoped that the snaps might catch the intruder and carry him away. But the Tricolores had apparently been wise to their efforts and had responded with fury, destroying the very image objects that it sought to confine him. Assenet did not rely on the media alone, however, in his effort to stem the assaults. He also engaged the Zionist prophet, who consulted the scriptures, washed the entire family with medicated water, and prescribed woolen cords to be worn around their bodies. Meanwhile, in the wake of all the publicity, healers and religious leaders of various stripes, from Catholic priests to Dignaka, came to offer their services. They all prayed and divined and placed cans of medicine on the roof and buried ritual horns in the ground to no avail. In late March, some 3 months after the Tricolores' first stroke, we visited the family, together with a patient local beat cop, Sergeant Manet, who kept a watching brief on the situation, but was clearly at his wit's end as to know what to do. Only the old woman was at home, and she reported disconsolately that Obed himself, the son, had gone off to search for work. She was afraid and alone. Samaiso, the boy who had first been attacked, had gone away to stay with his maternal grandmother in a nearby village, and when he returned and went to the toilet in the yard, the Tricolores tried to pull him down into the hole. The police visited regularly, healers came and went with little effect. We had to leave the Northwest for a while, and when we returned in early July, officers at the Le Magnanin police station reported that matters at Matlonyane had taken a turn for the better. When, together with Sergeant Monet, we drew up in front of the Sajeke home, we found Samaiso playing happily in the sun. The grandmother soon appeared and ushered us in. She reported that for 2 months the family had been free from attack. In the end, she herself had found a Naka, a diviner, who had treated the homestead and its occupants. The diviner had used various medicines, which had also been put in small boxes, hung from the rafters, and so on. Where had she found a healer who had succeeded when all others failed? The officiant, it turned out, was a fellow member of the Church of God. The Sojekas had long known of her reputation, but had been afraid to consult with her because of the cost of treatment. In desperation, they'd done so, and they'd been told that the affliction was tractable. The grandmother insisted that the identity of the assailant who had sent the tokolosh was moot, although she suspected it had something to do with the estranged daughter-in-law. After administering the treatment, the healer departed and sent assistants to check on the family from time to time. Now, when we discussed this outcome with Captain Asaneng, he remarked, "Sometimes the best solutions to people's problems are the ones that are closest to them, the ones within their own grasp." Now, this was a profound insight, but it was also an admission of failure. Despite this newfound confidence among local people, sometimes highly creative efforts on the part of the police to mobilize solutions drawn from customary practice, the police in the end were demonstrably powerless, for reasons both occult and ordinary, to intervene in these afflictions that were plaguing people in their everyday lives. Yet even where they were unable to prevail over this expanded array of assailants that are invading the humdrum intimate reaches of post-colonial life, the cops seem to feel drawn into collaborating in this fantasy of diviner detection. They struggle to engage these metaphysics of disorder, to somehow reconnect force with protection in the ordinary business of local enforcement. Okay, so a few conclusions. Modern social theorists, from Hobbes to Durkheim, Benjamin to Foucault, have tended to see society as born in the separation of law from lawlessness. The criminal, qua delinquent, has signal salience in these visions. For functionalist sociology, he was the negative against which the outlines of order took shape. Wrote Durkheim, "A society free of crime would fall into chaos, since it would be bereft of the signs of its own existence as a normative order." Now, for darker critical thinkers like Benjamin, the offender, the criminal, made authority visible in its repressive rather than its consensual aspect. The epic Criminal, he famously wrote, drew the secret admiration of the public in making visible, if only for an instant, the violent perpetuation of the law. Yet Benjamin was also captivated by another face of enforcement, by detection, and the possibility of identifying traces of transgression in the inanimate debris that it left in the world. Now, as I've implied, this idea of reading clues presumes that, like photography, clues are indexical, that is, that they capture events mimetically in all their contingency. Such indexicality, linguists point out, is the semiotic mode privileged in the signature technologies of modernity, from statistics and stenography to empirical reason. And it's integral to the forms of control that such kinds of scientific means make possible. But it's precisely this capacity to curb contingency, to tame chance, to use Hacking's term, that seems to have been occulted, drawn into question in the cases I've been discussing. Casting doubt on the legibility of the world and calling forth the special skills of a diviner detective, a Yonker or an Asaneng. Benjamin's compatriot, Ernest Mandel, was equally intrigued by the significance of sleuthing, pondering how it might be related to the other, more nakedly brutal face of policing. The detective emerges as a hero in life and art, he argued, at a particular historical juncture, when the law comes to be perceived less as a means of oppression than as a source of protection, this being closely tied to the recrafting of British criminal law in the interests of middle-class property owners. Now, certainly the image of the police as protectors of private possessions and persons, the kindly bobby on the beat, as it were, is enshrined in the kind of liberal view of the social contract. Equally established in the modern European imagination is the detective as the rationalist rather than the ruthless face of the law. In fact, the criminal investigator often serves as the epitome of applied social analysis. Shades here of the monk-turned-detective in Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, but also in Victor Turner's Ndembu Divina as a kind of social diagnostician. Yet precisely because it presumes the existence of received norms and procedures, the genre of detection also lends itself to critique of established order. of the plod of the leaden-footed of leaden-footed reason, as it were. And I'm invoking here Enid Blyton's laughably dull policeman, Mr. Plod. That critique is given compelling figuration in the form of rogue detectives and dyspeptic private eyes with these kind of critical film noir policemen, or in special cops like the Scorpions, who offer caustic comment on the brutality, corruption, but also often just the plodding ineptitude of conventional forces of law. My most immediate concern here in the spirit of Mandel has been the importance attached to this kind of special detection in recent South African history. This at a time when the rule of law and the nature of social order itself is profoundly in question, when crime serves as a spectre of a society unraveling, of order imploding. At this moment, a longing for authoritative regulation accompanies a real anxiety about the source and possibilities of governance, about the adequate relation of law as force to law as protection. In the old South Africa, matters were relatively straightforward and bifurcated. Black populations were policed, whites were protected. In the post-colony, old elites mourn the loss of safety, while the newly enfranchised feel cheated yet again of the ordinary securities synonymous with citizenship. It is in such circumstances, I suggest, that forensic figures here and elsewhere become the focus of a deep-seated desire to unite force with protection, a desire for sovereign authority that can rein in diffuse terrors that seem to be abounding on all sides. A longing also for law as a source of ontological order, capable of deciphering the mystery, reading the clues in a world in which violence and its motives seem increasingly spooky. Popular imagining, distrustful of politics as usual, put their trust in the work of this kind of theo-legality, aptly personified in super cops of one kind or another. Yet their faith in these preternatural figures also seems simultaneously to reinforce a deep sense of loss, a sense of exile at once nostalgic and fatalistic from the paternal protection of the state. The diviner detective, then, is a telling embodiment of the paradoxes of law, order, and sovereignty in this and other places, rapidly outrunning the political logos of classic modernity. Thank you.